This is the last chapter in Robert Friedrich's A Sociology of Sociology. It's called The Calling of Sociology. I have called this book A Sociology of Sociology. Many a reader, having followed the author along the paradigmatic trail blazed in the first six chapters, examined the dilemmas of choice and implicit commitment confronted in social research in the seventh and eighth, noted the presumptive faith of natural science and sociology's temptation to reify those assumptions in the ninth and tenth, and seen how the same issues have risen to plague those who stand within a Marxist frame in the past chapter. Perhaps indeed all who have journeyed this far would contend that the trek, although a provocative one, should not really be identified as a sociological exercise. For have we not couched the indicative within an imperative context and set a science within a frame that includes history and philosophy? Even if this were true, need we admit duplicity to masquerading as a sociology of when the book is in fact an argument for? There are two considerations that would make such a judgment premature. The first is rooted in the assumption that any and every science, sociology included, seeks to characterize the future through a study of order precipitated from the past. Because sociologists themselves are moved by contending philosophical and ideological postures, we must assess the factors confronting them in these areas before we can project their probable impact upon the sociological generation to come. The claim of predictive reliability, however, is only the lesser part of the case for the defense. The more important consideration must lie with the paradoxical nature of the task I have undertaken, which I drew to the reader's attention at the very beginning of the venture. Because I had set forth to characterize a discipline and its future by means of the very same discipline, whatever openness regarding the nature of the subject matter that I brought to the enterprise had to be shared with the method as well. Thus, the reader is not in a position to make a fully informed assessment of the appropriateness of calling a book a sociology of sociology until the substantive nature of the discipline is finally set forth. On the other hand, if the reader were willing to assume the author's integrity, he might, by extrapolating the book's position to this point, project in at least rough outline the image of the nature of the discipline and the context within which it must act. Let us see. I completed my examination of the revolutionary currents that had brought forth the conflict stance to challenge the system paradigm in recent American sociology by marking how a dialectical image had been introduced as a possible basis for a ceasefire between two warring schools. I then went on to point out that accompanying the rebirth of conflict theory had come a reassessment of the value-free stance that had accompanied the system image. This latter discovery suggested that the thesis developed by Thomas Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the point of departure for the entire volume, would be insufficient to the task of analyzing revolutions in the social and behavioral sciences. For we found that the social and behavioral sciences precipitated two paradigmatic levels rather than the single level addressed by Kuhn. Because such sciences are forced to encompass the scientist, his activity, and his self-image as part of their subject matter. Indeed, I suggested that the paradigms of which Kuhn spoke appeared to be functions of, or at least secondary to, a more primary level. The system paradigm appeared to be a product of a prior commitment to a paradigmatic image of the sociologist as value-free, the conflict paradigm an outcome of the paradigmatic vision of the sociologist as engage, someone who would engage with what he studies, or she. It should be abundantly clear by now that those involved in social research are incapable, even in principle, of disengaging themselves in the manner in which value freedom has typically been understood in sociology. If one is more sophisticated and perceives the latter phrase, with Becker and Northrop, as merely limiting one to a set of values that are assumed by, or lie implicit within, the scientific stance, or indeed are necessitated by the communal life of an ongoing scientific subcommunity, as with David Bidney, then one may indeed remain free of other values, at least in principle. But chapters 10 and 11 suggested that sacrifices that would have to be made. Efficiency would become ego's transcendent end, and control his indisputed means, with his relationship to alter inhibited by no vision beyond an image of man as an ordered object in a completely relative field. Some might stretch their valuation the additional half-step demanded by a demythologized yet essentially orthodox Marxism. But in doing so, they would have to abandon the humanistic sensitivities of the early Marx that had led to his persuasive analysis of alienation. Prognosis. But it takes no extraordinary sociological perception to conclude that this more subtle route through the valuational dilemma will not appeal to more than a handful of sociologists, East or West. Although many of them will continue to act as if they are acceptable merely by intellectual and ethical default as they cling to the traditional identification of value neutrality with objectivity, the overwhelming majority would find any stark rejection of these images and associated ethics, which the West derives from its Hellenic and Hebraic roots, or indeed of those analogous metaphors which undergird the mythic life of other worldwide religious philosophical communities, to be quite untenable. And well they might, for the demanding lens of science has had to sacrifice the personal existentia dimension in human experience, with its accent upon man as inviolate end, freedom and responsibility as substantively real, and one's intra-subjective experience as transcendent, so that its logic might fulfill with integrity its special calling, delineating order over time. That which is common to the sciences is not a product, but a means, as the traditional phrase, quote, the scientific method, reminds us. And when a method, or logic, seeks guidance only from within itself, it projects the very same feature upon its subject matter. The sociology that seeks its bearing internally thus sees man as but means. Such a posture not only must be rejected, but is. Sociologists in America not only are well on their way to rejecting a simplistic identification of objectivity with value freedom, but have become increasingly willing to acknowledge the appropriateness of alternative value references within which to frame their research. Prophecy or priestcraft. In the ideal typical language of this volume, then, the discipline can be expected to continue to move towards a reclamation of its original prophetic understanding of itself and away from the exclusively priestly paradigm that dominated the post-war period to the end of the 1950s. The sociologist as priest, viewing his office as but a means by which any given social reality may be revealed to the layman, had overestimated his capacity to refrain from transfiguring the quality of that reality through the selectivity of his perception and the special interests that adhere to that office, as the custodians of orthodoxy traditionally have been inclined to do. On the other hand, the sociologist as prophet is consciously committed to an image of society that transcends any given social reality. He therefore uses his predictive powers to portray quite realistically a future state of empirical reality that quite normally may be expected to ensue, given no change in that social matrix other than the potential impact of his own prediction. He differs from the sociologist as priest not in any temptation to distort reality of a given situation. He is equally dedicated to honoring the empirical facts, but in his awareness of the value-laden choices and implicit commitments confronting those who would extrapolate evidence of past order into future, and in his decision to respond to them in a way in which his own comprehension and predictive agency will make it a significant factor for change through its impact upon his fellow sociologists and the lay public. The priests' perceptions and predictions cannot, of course, avoid having an impact that is rooted in the same feedback principle. But because he draws his image of man, and thus an implicit ethic, consciously or unconsciously from a frame of reference that honors ordered efficiency above all, the manner in which he resolves the value decisions confronting him in the precipitation of that order will muffle the impact of his projections and or turn from self-defeating prophecies to self-fulfilling ones, from liberating change to increased stability. Although the criteria upon which one may draw thus lie outside the epistemological competence of science alone, a decision regarding the relative emphasis to be placed upon the one mode as over against the other cannot be avoided. If it is not resolved explicitly, it will be implicitly. My own predilection to re-emphasize the integrity of the discipline's original prophetic inclination should now be self-evident, and it is clear that more and more sociologists lately have turned to the same direction. Having opted for a revival of the prophetic image, should I then urge that conflict be chosen in preference to system as sociology's substantive referent? I think not. At least if we seek a conceptual frame at the highest theoretical level. There is no need to assume that just because we have uncovered a correlational, functional, or even causal link between the prophetic and conflict paradigms on the one hand and the priestly and system images on the other, that the relationship need be expected to project itself compulsively into the future. Indeed, if we are to be completely serious about the prophetic paradigm, its capacity to deny complete continuity through the impact of the awareness of past order would undermine such continuity. But there is a considerably more fundamental reason for my and the discipline's unwillingness to settle for conflict as sociology's ultimate substantive referent. Okay, the legacy of Talcott Parsons. The scientific community has become increasingly aware over the last two or three generations that its singularity, its one common bond, lies in its dedication to the extraction of order from the flux of human experience. Social existence may well be fundamentally out of joint, conflicting, unsystematic. But even if it is, the presumptive cement that serves as bond between the varying subcommunities of science would be incapable of responding to that circumstance other than by viewing it as but one more challenge to its own ability to bring cognitive order out of apparent chaos. This I have tried to make clear in Chapter 9 by tracing the route taken by that community towards self-understanding, and by revealing the bylaws that appear to govern its activity. One of these bylaws, you will recall, is the assumption that all empirical phenomena are in the final analysis interrelated. Its derivation, like the derivation of the bylaws of intersubjectivity and recurrence, had been solely pragmatic. Seeking to order experience over time, those who came to identify their activity with the adjective scientific eventually had to conclude that any other assumption would inhibit their cert, prejudge the limits of order available to them. Presuming the relational character of empirical phenomena thus guaranteed the open-mindedness of the scientific task, not its bow. And yet, paradoxically, its product has had to be portrayed ultimately in, quote, system language. For that which is completely interrelated is, by definition, a system. Talcott Parsons is right in recognizing that the term must be regarded as a, perhaps the, primary sociological referent, if sociology is to be viewed as a science. It is what Kingsley Davis meant when he identified functionalism in its broadest sense with sociological theory in general. From such a perspective, functions are the relata that link the structural features of a society. This is not to say that conflict becomes an illegitimate concept, but even it must be approached in fundamentally system terms if one wishes to remain within the frame of reference that has undergirded the development of natural science. Conflict, if not patterned, is abandoned to the ideographic sensitivities of the historian. Only by redefining sociology as history might it be reclaimed. Thus, conflict is presumed, must be presumed, to be functional in the most general sense of the term. Where Parsons has gone astray has been in adding to this presumption a misinterpretation of Newton's fundamental laws of motion. As Cotton has deftly pointed out, the latter were in fact axioms, which held that physicists need not bother to explain continuity of action. The axioms simply represent a way of registering the assumption of order that science must make. Parsons and Dodd and Lundberg read into Newton's laws a strain toward equilibrium, a notion that has no presumptive place in the fundamental grammar of science. Behavioral or otherwise, social phenomena may or may not illustrate homeostatic tendencies at any given time or place. The issue is clearly an important one, and one that is open to empirical examination. Conflict or system? The fundamental error in Parsons' general theory is that it tends to build what is merely a possibility into the very rhetoric of its underlying vocabulary. It is a mistake that Freud did not make, even though he too was organismically informed. Freud set forth both a life and a death, suggesting that he took much more seriously than Parsons one of the central themes in our Hebraic heritage. Parsons' disclaimer of William Kolb's effort to do just that, to build a theoretical structure upon an essentially Hebraic base, is at least consistent, for Parsons' equilibrating predilection would appear to have considerably more in common with the central predisposition of Eastern religious philosophical thought. System? Yes. By the very assumptions necessary to maintain an open frontier to the pursuit of further evidence of order. Equilibrium? Maybe yes, maybe no. But in either case, it must remain at the level of hypothesis, to be addressed in terms of the empirical evidence applicable to the particular case. Certainly, it would not appear self-evidently fruitful to grant it a paradigmatic status given the present level of our knowledge of social man. Conflict? Unfortunately, no. It is incapable of serving as the fundamental paradigmatic referent simply because its ultimate implication undermines sociology's assumption of and search for order. Conflict can serve as the conceptual keystone only if sociology is to be regarded primarily as one of the ideographic humanities. And although I have taken pains to document in chapters 4 and 5 that the undercurrent running through the discipline in the 60s flowed strongly in that direction, the economic and prestige factors that accompany membership in the community of science in the present generation are certain to continue to block its course in the foreseeable future. Furthermore, many of those who have argued the case for conflict appear in fact to have retained an implicit system approach, one that has a readily identifiable root in patterned historicism. A final reason for concluding that the present paradigmatic battle, if limited to a choice between system and conflict, is more likely to be won by the former, lies in the impact of computer technology on sociology. Originally regarded simply as a means for circumventing what earlier had been viewed as insurmountable in social research, the manipulation of large numbers of variables, complex calculation of lengthy statistical formulas, and the storage and retrieval of mountains of data, the systematic quality of the digital computer is fast coming to be seen as a powerful model in its own right for the structure and functions of social systems. While well above the horizon is the prospect that Fortran, the Esperanto of the digital world, may in fact become the instrumental language of social analysis. Both developments cannot help but reinforce and deepen the system image at the level of theory. Again, the conflict image need not be ruled out. It may indeed gain a new lease on life, as the surge in the direction of game theory has suggested, but game theory, as well as any other models of conflict that can be programmed, must, by the very nature of the logic that had been built into the computer and programs it uses along with the rules that govern the relationship between players, presuppose a system context.
even simulated war games are governed by the larger assumption of system, the dialectical image. But what of the hint provided at the end of Chapter 2 that a dialectical image may play an increasingly attractive mediating role between system and conflict paradigms? The decision on the part of Charles Loomis, who had identified himself with the former camp in both his Social Systems and Modern Social Theories volumes in the early 60s, to title his presidential address before the American Sociological Association in 1967 in praise of conflict and its negation, would appear to grant both official sanction and considerable encouragement to the possibility. Underwritten by the recent recovery, in quotes, of Marx as sociologist, the option might be strengthened by the suggestion that the dialectic foundered at Marx's and or Engels' hands when they extrapolated it beyond the social sciences and used it as a stencil for the entire realm of nature. Thus, with the discovery that it was considerably more of a nuisance than an aid in the physical and biological sciences, social and behavioral scientists in the West abandoned the dialectic altogether. As the realization grows that the substantive focus of sociology includes social research and the resultant awareness that the very precipitation and comprehension of past and present order will inevitably to some degree be fed back through social interaction to deny that order, a dialectical paradigm becomes increasingly tenable. Neither system nor conflict need be denied. Rather, they become necessary elements within a larger dialectical gestalt. Formally, a system would still take cognitive priority over conflict simply because the former must be presupposed. But conflict is always in principle a partial product, even though it in turn contributes, as in the classic formation of the dialectic, to a new moment of stability. Suddenly, the compelling critiques offered in the name of a new, quote, humanistic sociology can be seen as more than simply cries of anguish over an intellectual adolescence that has been outgrown. All speak to the ideographic in human experience when it is in dynamic relationship to the nomothetic, the disjunctive linked with the functional, conflict harnessed with system. Although reaching beyond the traditional language of science, the metaphors they offer point toward a presumptive base for sociology that is itself interactive. If the dialectic does not seriously challenge conflict and system for paradigmatic status during the 70s, it will not be because of inadequate formal credential. Epistemological pluralism. At the same time, a note of caution would seem in order. As powerful a searchlight as sociology indeed promises to be, its conceptual apparatus is not and cannot be the measure of all things. We and our world may well be in the singular, but the epistemologies by which the modern world has been structured and is known remain perforce in the plural. Sociologists might wish to claim an all-encompassing clarity and insight for the chosen field, but they should be aware of the danger of mixing both metaphors and logics. When we were children, we spoke as children, as Comte, as Marx, even as Durkheim. But now that we are grown, we must put away childish hopes and recognize that epistemological segmentation is the price that we must pay, at least in our time, for clarity. Sociology cannot contain the wealth and depth of all socially relevant experience within its own conceptual, theoretical, and logical reservoirs. If it would claim the cognitive reliability that is the peculiar presumptive power of a scientific rhetoric, it must set competing claims in another frame. Praxis, ecstasy, subjective realm, authenticity, all refer to an image of man that would underline his existential integrity, his freedom to risk, and the moral nature of his responsibility, and would grant his history a fundamental direction and relevance. It is a portrait that I would honor, but it is not one that should drive us from methodological sure-footedness, away from the patient and precise ordering of the given empirical world towards a well-intentioned but woolly-headed confusion of tongue. The dilemma that in fact gnaws at the base of sociology today lies precisely here. how to commit ourselves to an enterprise that must screen out the existential and yet claim it as a fundamental referent. Nested frames? The key that would unlock the paradox is the recognition that the competing frames are not simply alternative, but nested as well. The eyes we all have, scientists and non-scientists alike, register experiences that cluster about the complementary poles of the intrasubjective and the intersubjective, the unique and the recurrent, the existential and the relational. Given a preference for efficient prediction, some, eventually all at times, will use a polarized lens to filter out the first of each pair and focus simply on the second, projecting order over time in the manner of science. Given the opposite aim, the delineation of the intrasubjective, unique, and existential in experience, a complementary lens may be substituted that blocks the opposite polarities, thus projecting those elements of experience that the present generation has claimed in the names of existence. But notice the analogy carefully. Neither the polarized lens is of any value. Indeed, nothing whatsoever will be registered if the original eye is not present. Each of the alternative lenses rests upon, or is nested within, the prior experience and perceptive capacity of the given eye for both its utility and its meaning. At one level, then, we may speak appropriately of alternative lenses or frames of discourse. But in doing so, we should never allow ourselves to ignore the fact that a nested hierarchy of lenses, one artificial and one given, is the more fundamental epistemological paradigm. How is it that sociologists have missed this self-evident feature of man's experience? Why is it that they have continued so long to assume naively that man is either scientist or layman? Social researcher or potential subject, sociologist or member of a larger, all-encompassing community. The reason lies, as we discovered in Chapter 6, in the manner in which sociologists have reified the concept of role. Although borrowed from the language of drama, the term took on the texture of reality in the social behaviorism extracted from the larger corpus of George Herbert Mead and became, with system, one of the fundamental points of reference for recent American sociology. Finding the concept a powerful tool within their discipline, sociologists lifted it bodily out of the realm of its special competence and applied it as a primary criterion for framing the nature of man's original, given I. The two then were identified. All we were left with were alternating lenses, alternating roles. The nested relationship had dissolved. The activities of sociologists as scientists, however, are always and in principle nested in a larger frame that includes the intrasubjective, the unique, and the existential. And it is because we are never able to extricate ourselves from that context, even when we take on the, quote, role of sociologist as scientist, that the image of man resident within the rhetoric of science may serve as a powerful tool in the service of a more fundamentally realistic and humane paradigm. Okay, the Sartrean alternative reconsidered. We mentioned toward the end of Chapter 11 how social scientists operating within a Marxian context might find the humanistic elements in Marx or a Sartrean reinterpretation a strategic route by which to shake themselves free of the scientific frame of orthodox Marxism. To do so, liberties would have to be taken with the historical record. For the evidence available to date suggests that neither the early Marx nor Sartre represented the epistemological or the substantive portion taken by the mature Marx, to say nothing of Engels or Lenin. Still, given the relative success by which the Christian West has been able to reinterpret the essentially apocalyptic message of the New Testament to fit the existential needs of each passing intellectual generation, the task would not be impossible. What does seem quite unlikely is that either one in the foreseeable future could attract and contain the larger community of Western, and thus largely American, sociologists. For better or for worse, the Marxist label worn by both will eliminate them as potential victors in the paradigmatic struggle we witness today in American sociology. Research, even in sociology, is too closely tied to the vocabulary and needs of the body politic in the United States, and the latter is too self-consciously anti-communist to allow either to become major contenders in the foreseeable future. The case against the Sartrean posture is more complex. It cannot be challenged on the same basis as Fromm's portrait of an original Marx, for Sartre explicitly denies the fundamental validity of much of the Marx corpus. But two elements within the latter that he does accept diminish the likelihood that a Sartrean existence will ever serve as a context for sociology in the West. They are its emphasis on negation and on violence. Negation. The dialectic that provides the structural framework for Sartre's posture is grounded, as with Marx, in Hegel. Not the trinity that is thesis, antithesis, synthesis, but rather that of affirmation, negation, and the negation of negation. The latter, the negation of negation, is a key phrase in the Critique. Its significance lies in the allegation that only the future may harbor the positive. All that is present demands a negative response. Man's freedom here and now, and of course man is condemned always to live in a here and now, lies simply in his capacity to say no, epitomized ultimately in his ability to say no to existence itself, to move from being to non-being through suicide. Only that which man must negate is in fact conceivable. The nature of his ultimate freedom is not. When one moves beyond the words to the man, negation stands out with equal vividness. Sartre's political activity has always been action against, beginning with his work with the French underground against the Nazis and continuing with his opposition to orthodox Marxism, to the shifting power structure of France, to the Algerian War, and more recently through participation in a mock war crimes trial, to American involvement in Vietnam. That pattern has, of course, been shared with many Frenchmen over the past generation. Its specifics, however, have not. The refusal to join the Communist Party while advocating that the French proletariat and others should, the rejection of the Nobel Prize for Literature, a refusal to honor invitations he had accepted to speak before academic circles in the United States because of the Vietnam War, perhaps even his simple refusal to marry. The ideology, the philosophy, and the man appear as one in the predilection for negative action. They may also be one in their inability to grasp the ordered, the structured, the positive as anything but a further negation of negation. This could be a heavy burden to a student of society who already is all too aware of the flux that is his subject matter, who seeks to find order in the eddies of change itself, who may search for theories of the short or middle range that promise relatively reliable prediction over limited periods of time. And although the concept of negation and the negation of negation may appear to inform those moments of history heavy with violence and revolution, they are apt to appear curiously situation-bound when we address ourselves to cultural contexts and eras other than our own. Violence. Such negation spills over into his image of man per se, granting ontological and ethical status to violence. Quote, man is violent against the anti-man, that is, against any man, and against his brother, as being such that he can at any time become an anti-man. End quote. Such violence cannot be avoided, for if the laborer is to become conscious of the manner in which the economic system has minimized his share of the results of his work, he must internalize an awareness of scarcity. This internalization is then defined as the premised violence. His treatment of scarcity, in turn, makes the Sartrean package even less acceptable, shifting from the term desire in Being in Nothingness to need in the Critique, in order to justify a Marxian treatment of scarcity. He falls into the same trap that, as we saw in Chapter 5, has claimed many sociologists. That is, he seems to assume that man's needs may be determined simply by cataloging those things man has striven for in the past. In doing so, he reproduces the very error he had set out explicitly to challenge, that of projecting limits on future behavior on the basis of past behavior. He would, in other words, move back within the very circle of a deterministic logic that Existenge was formulated to avoid. Furthermore, scarcity is defined merely in economic terms. Provide an economy that creates and assures universal abundance and an era of freedom, with its absence of conflict, even an end to the negation of the negation, is upon us. This would represent a shockingly naive understanding of the human being as a social animal, for there is utterly no evidence to lead anyone sensitized to the subtleties of social existence to believe that once a human being's material needs have been met, his strive with his fellows will cease, or indeed, when an entire society's physical needs have been so satisfied. The evidence of man's ceaseless striving for ego advantage is simply all too abundant to demand detailing here. No, the Sartrean effort, although it may challenge the priestly and system modes as they are set forth in both Marxist and non-Marxist contexts, is not in a position to offer American sociologists a suitable framework even in the longer run. An increasing number of sociologists would argue, as we noted in chapters 2 and 6, that a socialized phenomenology might be sufficient to the task. Certainly, the renewal of interest in Husserl by philosophers and the recent translation and publication of Alfred Schutz's collective works and his early phenomenology of the social world, together with the vivid and socially sophisticated efforts of such younger social theorists as Peter Berger, Thomas Luckman, Edward Tyriakian, Harold Garfinkel, and Burkhard Holzner, signal an important new turn for, quote, general theory, and one that promises to raise the profession's level of contextual awareness considerably. Roots. Husserl, trained as he was in mathematics, physics, and philosophy, set out to construct nothing less than a completely reliable science of the subjective. Aware that natural science was burdened by a set of largely unrecognized assumptions, he claimed that through a technique of self-conscious phenomenological reduction, the apperception of the impact of phenomena upon one's consciousness, devoid of reference to the actual presence or absence of external objects. Through this, he had framed an epistemology freed of all but self-evident assumptions. The phenomena abstracted were in turn seen to structure themselves within a format of universally present and relatively invariant ideen, and found to relate themselves in the life histories of individuals and society to an inverse suspension of doubt in the, quote, reality of, quote, everyday life on the latter's part. Needless to say, the self-evident nature of the position was questioned by many, with perhaps his most promising student, Martin Heidegger, breaking away to become philosophy's leading exponent of existentialism and succeeding to Husserl's chair at Freiburg. Rather than claim either the certainty or the freedom from presuppositions that Husserl was wont to do, Heidegger focused upon that element of risk that adheres to an existence that must confront, as its primary datum, the threat of non-being. Instead of projecting a set of systematically interrelated and quasi-Platonic ideen, the latter drew a portrait of the concrete individual forced to adopt responsibility of making choices in a setting of substantive freedom. Rather than painting experience in the neutral hues of an invariant structure of consciousness, whose appeal would be to man's search for rational order, his canvas was colored by a call to the commitment necessary for authentic existence. Instead of the cool bracketing out of all but the impact made by phenomena upon the consciousness, Heidegger reclaimed for philosophy dimensions of human experience that had been abandoned as idiosyncratic by both science and philosophy. In other words, instead of seeking to grasp by introspection the phenomena of both inter- and intrasubjective experience, within the web of an essentially scientific frame of reference, Heidegger renounced the value of the intersubjective lens of science for an understanding of the human condition that he felt was available to it through the depth of the intrasubjective alone. Alfred Schutz. Still, a social theorist such as Alfred Schütz, who sought a firmer base than that provided by existentialism and yet would not abandon the subjective dimension of human experience, could find much that was attractive in the phenomenological stance. For one thing, he saw it sharing with existentialism the conviction that the knowledge that one must die and the fear of that death stood as primordial data of human existence, although it would have to be seen as presenting itself within the phenomena of consciousness, rather than as the direct threat of non-being to being, as would be the case with Heidegger. It is Schütz's interpretation of man's reaction to that threat, however, that provides the key to the larger posture. Following Husserl, man is seen as inverting the phenomenologist's doubt of all but the phenomena of consciousness. In order to cloak his anxiety, man suspends doubt in the paramount reality of everyday life. Everyday life, together with the natural attitude with which it was associated, then becomes the paradigmatic focus of analysis. It is in turn characterized as action-oriented. That is, the meaning reflected by the natural attitude towards the world of everyday life originates in and is instituted by chosen, motivated acts. The individual, although confronting a world that is largely a shared world of typical images and meanings, whose genesis is set forth in terms akin to those of Cooley and George Herbert Mead, discovers his projects, his purposes, confronted by unique constellations of events that demand choice. Whether his act, the outcome of his choice, is identical with his action, his preconceived project, he alone knows. Others may only approach certainty by sharing in the common definitions of everyday life. Even the failure to act is choice, for it is an explicit or implicit decision not to act. Still, the desire to change one's environment is regarded as such a central factor within the natural attitude that Schütz considered work, the archetypical image of human reality. Only when an individual is confronted by a problem for which no resolution is provided by the range of typical meanings available in everyday life is the natural attitude threatened. He is forced at that point, if he would seek a solution, toward a Kierkegaardian leap of faith from the natural attitude to an alternative finite realm of meaning, one which fails to share a common cognitive frame with the natural attitude. One such realm is sociology. Man as sociologist is to accept the former world of everyday life as his subject matter, his only subject matter, but in doing so he is to superimpose an additional layer of typicalities that are justified by the aims of the new province. He does so by constructing ideal types through the method of Verstehen in the manner of Max Weber, especially models of rational actions. To these he applies the logic and standards of verification common to natural science, except that Schütz would not limit the term empirical observation to sensory perceptions of the outer world, but would extend its meaning to include that experience by which common sense thinking in everyday life understands human actions and their outcomes in terms of their underlying motives or goals. The aim of such a social science, Schütz tells us, is to reconstruct in a simplified manner the way in which healthy, wide-awake adults, in his words, interpret their world. Yet it does not purport to be identical, even in principle, with that world. It self-consciously distorts the natural attitude by abstracting from it those elements that fit the fully systematic model appropriate to the ends of science. The result is an image of social man as but a puppet of the typicalities of association and in reference to which such terms as motive, action, or project, immediately appropriate to the realm of the natural attitude of everyday life, should always, when confronted with the province of science, be interpreted as if in quotation marks. It is a distortion that must be justified by the systematic understanding and thus predictive utility afforded by the latter realm of meaning. Although much of this is compelling, it is startling to discover that Schütz could then go on to portray the sociologist qua sociologist as aloof, detached, and completely uninvolved in, quote, action, as impinging only upon the cognitive dimension of existence, as merely an observer and not an actor in the world around him. Indeed, he goes so far as to state that his theoretical activity may not even be considered work. A crucial clue that to the respect he would grant sociology and apparently all the pure sciences, when one recalls that work, to Schütz, served as the ideal typical mode of human action. Indeed, scientific activity is viewed as a point of refuge where, having made the leap into disinterestedness, the sociologist and his colleagues may somehow now find themselves freed even of that existential anxiety that was set forth as the source of the suspension of doubt in everyday reality. It is clear that he has, with relative accuracy, described the natural attitude reflected in the everyday life of the sociologist of his day. Still, his naive acceptance of that self-image places the utility of Schütz's entire effort in question. The phenomenological task draws its fundamental attractiveness from its claim, the assertion that it is able to deal cognitively, systematically, and reliably with the intrasubjective as well as the intersubjective. Added to this has been its appreciation of existentialism's fundamental point of reference, the threat of non-being, and the generic and dialectical relationship that the two philosophies have demonstrated over the years, the manner in which man, even social man, is viewed primarily as actor rather than as respondent, its corresponding emphasis upon change rather than stability, its provision for fundamentally discrete realms that cannot be contained within a common cognitive scheme, the awareness of the manner in which the product of a science is limited by its assumptions, and the sophisticated manner in which Weber's Verstehen sociology and the interactionism of Cooley and Mead are interwoven. Yet the cost would appear too great for sociologists to bear, moving as they are into a period of epistemological self-awareness. The root of the trouble lies with Husserl's explicit and Schütz's implicit point of departure, the conviction that there was a presuppositionless, or at the very least, a persuasively self-evident, mode of confronting experience that would be amenable to systematic, cognitive, and thus reliable explanation. That there could indeed be a science built upon a base that included experience that was in principle private in its immediate givenness. In other words, the phenomenological reduction became the 20th century's peculiar contribution to the perennial quest for a certainty that would escape the net of implicit commitment accompanying any presumptive context. Instead, it has simply joined that lengthy lineage recited in Chapter 5, each of which, presuming finally to free cognition from valuation, has had rather to accept the label of a philosophical predisposition, for it shifted its complexion from a radical psychologism through a neutralism to a transcendental idealism, even in the hands of Husserl himself, and upon Husserl's death, was splintered into a wide variety of disputatious schools by his followers. This pretension of freedom from substantive assumptions was carried over immediately to a comparable pretension regarding the suspension of doubt that is the epoché of the natural attitude. The world that is everyday life is treated as self-evidently as ultimate or paramount reality, and becomes the center of Schütz's attention. Some would be tempted to identify the original given lens, the full range of man's inter- and intrasubjective experience of which I spoke earlier, with such a natural attitude toward the everyday world. Indeed, this would appear to be akin to the tact taken by Gibson Winter in his recent and provocative Elements for a Social Ethic, Scientific and Ethical Perspectives on Social Process. Unfortunately, it is quite clear that this was not Schütz's intention. He would restrict such a natural attitude to the typicalities that frame a wide awake and doubt-free apprehension of everyday life. It is not designed to encompass all of experience, even all of social experience. Rather, it is self-consciously limited to a single province of meaning that is reputedly shared socially as the natural one in the adult workaday world. It is this world from which the individual turns only when confronted with a problem that is unresolvable within it, with a shock that breaks the limits of the natural attitude and forces one to leap into another finite province of meaning. One of the provinces is, as we mentioned earlier, the realm of social science. But even sociologists, according to Schutz, must limit themselves to second-order typologies of the first-order typifications that form the content of the natural attitude. The appropriate empirical referent of one's sociological conceptualization, then, is doubly narrowed thereby, a renunciation that is not likely to be accepted by a discipline that has often exhibited an even more voracious appetite for the socially atypical than the typical. And when one notes the substantive nature of those areas that must be ruled out because they fall outside of the realm of the natural attitude of everyday life, those social phenomena which reflect unresolved conflict, or are in response to atypical crisis situations on the one hand, or which depart radically from the archetypical image of work, as play would appear to do, on the other, one is forced to conclude that the limitation not only will not do, but should not do. The phenomenological tradition, as it is mediated by Alfred Schutz, then, is unsuited in its present form for either the immediate or contextual needs of sociology. It founders initially in its claim to be both presuppositionless and reliable. Its attempt to escape a positivistic realism on the one side and a naive idealism on the other side results in a methodological reification of a mundane and doubly typified everyday life drained of the leaven of both fundamental anxiety and play. And it perceives the sociologist qua sociologist not only in the discredited and simplistic value-free terms that dominated the sociology of the 40s and 50s, yet goes further by denying him even the active quality denoted by work. As impressive as its claim to safeguard the subjective, purposive dimension of experience may be, the price asked cannot help but be deemed unrealistic by a sociology approaching epistemological sophistication. David Berger. This is not to say that fruitful revisions of the phenomenological lineage represented by Schutz may not be forthcoming. Indeed, one of the most intriguing would appear in the process of development at the hands of Peter Berger. Though acknowledging a major debt to Schutz, as his works to date clearly testify, Berger adds an accent that is decidedly his own. Rather than penning sociology within the narrow boundaries of a scheme of second-order typifications, and perceiving its aim as but the reconstruction of the common-sense world of man living his everyday life among his fellow men, he would allow its subject matter to encompass both the broad range of social facts of a Durkheim and the empathetic sensitivity of a Weber. Berger's aim is to shake man free, even if but for a moment, of the fictions that he himself has constructed quite unconsciously into an everyday reality that in fact serves to imprison and manipulate him. Although Schutz too recognizes common sense reality as a human byproduct, he treats it with almost sacred regard, as all of us tend to treat that which we regard as of paramount reality. Berger, however, would desacralize it as our larger tradition would desacralize all that is simply the byproduct of man himself. The natural attitude towards everyday life becomes in Berger's hand and those of his associates not the be-all and the end-all of the entire sociological enterprise, but rather an exceptionally fruitful focus for an enlarged exercise in the sociology of knowledge. Where Schutz would have sociology simply seek to understand that common sense world, Berger conceives sociology as a medium by which we are able to transcend the determinate forms and meanings we ourselves as men have given it. In other words, through a process analogous to the way in which a psychoanalyst assists his patients in uncovering and thus understanding the compulsive routines and meanings he himself has fashioned in response to the need for security. Sociologists may, through an extension of the perspective of the sociology of knowledge, portray to the layman the manner in which society, or one of its subsystems, routinizes its own structures and meanings in the name of reality, or the natural, and so subjects man to a socialized prison of his own making, or when those norms have been unselfconsciously internalized, as they typically are held to have been, to the unauthentic life of the puppet. When the genesis of a particular social compulsion, cognitive or behavioral, has been carefully and accurately described and understood as such, the conditions necessary to transcend it are at hand. One then becomes capable of standing outside the internalized norm, the prescribed role, the cultural expectation, or the structural niche for a shorter or longer period. Indeed, the cognitive norms of the language of contemporary sociology, role system, generalized order, are themselves seen as socially derived fictions, equally capable in principle of being transcended. The attractiveness, then, of a phenomenologically informed format for the sociology of the 1970s may be quite formidable. It will have to take the general direction of the Berger modification, however, if it would seek paradigmatic stature. For the posture of Alfred Schütz, following hard upon that of Husserl, is essentially a priestly one, satisfied with the approximate communication of what is regarded as paramount reality, rather than motivated by the claim of transcendence. And we have already acknowledged that sociology is now directed, and can be expected in the immediate future to move, towards the prophetic role. That Berger has built up abundant momentum in the latter direction is self-evident. But the strength of Berger's posture is also its weakness, at least vis-a-vis its acceptability as paradigm for the many within the discipline who continue to view sociology as integrally related to natural science. As influential as his invitation to sociology has been, it was greeted when reviewed in its profession's major official journal by one of its discipline's less conservative minds with undisguised hostility as an attempt to transform an even-tempered science into a debunking exercise. Perhaps the subtitle Berger gave the volume, A Humanistic Perspective, provides the crucial clue. Most sociologists in America, although they are becoming aware of the manner in which the social scientists may begin to serve as a bridge between the two cultures, will not in the immediately foreseeable future be willing to renounce their image of sociology as a science, nor return to the Wissenschaft definition, traditional to the continent, encompassing as it does any systematic cognitive endeavor. Yet the latter representations, by and large, the intellectual context out of which and in terms of which Berger speaks. This is not to say that it is wrong-headed. Such a return may well be our appropriate destiny in the longer run, and Berger, again, one of its prophets. At the very least, it represents a spring to which the more segmented, specialized inclinations of the new world have periodically returned for creative insight and for breaking parochial linguistic habits, and which gives every appearance of maintaining the strength necessary to play a similarly liberating role in the future. But from the evidence that it is the state of contemporary sociology, it is quite clear that such a frame places too great a burden on the undeniably attractive vision that Berger has begun to share with the larger profession, which makes his imagery incapable at the moment of winning a clear-cut victory in the battle for paradigmatic supremacy, or even for serving as the basis for a collaborative ceasefire. The test of the Berger vision of the phenomenological posture, then, must await the passage of a decade or more, by which time he and his associates and students will have blocked out more fully the range of its implications and resolved those apparent inconsistencies that are the price of any new major theoretical departure. By that time, too, these generations of graduate students who returned during the 1960s to the prophetic stance abandoned by their predecessors will be an increasingly dominant factor in the discipline. Among those issues that one would expect by that time to have been resolved would be Berger's apparent reluctance in the midst of an insistence that sociology be seen as a debunking dialect aimed at establishing conditions which would make transcendence of a given social reality possible. to in fact give up the traditional value-free characterization of the discipline, together with the related legacy of Husserl and Schütz, which argues that the sociological enterprise appropriately strives to be but an act of pure perception. Imperative 2 will be the clarification of the essential difference, if any, between his expanded image of a sociology of knowledge and sociological theory, humanistically conceived in general. The most fundamental problem facing Berger, however, is his apparent unwillingness to grant that processes involved in the structuring of a given reality of everyday life ontological status, equivalent to those that contribute to its transcendence. In other words, his inability to date to grant these forces that would guarantee stability to the flux that is human social experience, the same stature he would give the disjunctive. The larger discipline, although increasingly sensitized to its contextual setting by those writing from a phenomenological and or an existential, historical, or philosophical perspective, will almost certainly continue over the immediate years ahead to continue to perceive of itself as a science intimately linked to the natural sciences through its dedication to the delineation of order in the social world. Although there will be fierce rearguard action on the part of those who would save the phrase value-free for its undoubted public relations value, the concept is fated to wither appreciably. Or, if it is to survive, it must be transformed into the modest and accurate claim that the verbal product of social research is always to be stated in the indicative, never in the imperative. The major shift will be the increasingly open admission that neither sociology nor any other science has operated nor can operate simply from within its own functional integrity for its normative standards, if one would sustain the values that the West derives from its Hellenic and Hebraic roots and other cultural traditions. The conditions for such an awareness have always lain implicit within the nature of sociology, for science could easily be seen as but one among many human communal activities. It was not until relatively recently, however, that the sociology of knowledge spawned a fledgling sociology of science to document in engaging detail the humanity, the ineradicably value-laden color of that subculture. Now it in turn has given place to a, quote, sociology of sociology, promising to advance the discipline's awareness of its own peculiar lifestyle and the fictions that support it enormously. That this book seeks to contribute to that end cannot be denied, but it should be clear that the outlines of the picture drawn herein are etched deeply enough into sociology's recent history to have made this particular effort expendable. Primacy of the personal. What the sociology of the immediate future will seek is some intelligible manner of grasping the strengths and the limitations of its scientific, in quotes, perspective relative to the larger context it has finally acknowledged as being contained within, yet neither succumbing to the tempting but tautological trap of returning to the epistemology of the science it would envelop, nor resigning itself to the web that is paradox. One such possibility has been offered by John McMurray, a Scottish philosopher so moved by the interactionist implications of sociology to have titled the volumes that were to sum his life's work and point towards a new departure for philosophy, The Self as Agent, and Persons in Relation. Acknowledging that the metaphorical sensitivities of existentialism have served to focus our attention on the crucial philosophical problem of our age, the crisis of the personal, McMurray, although content to remain within the rhetoric traditional to the discipline, sets forth from a radically new point of departure, rejecting as egocentric the assumption that the self may act as pure subject in registering the world as object. He offers action, in quotes, as the fundamental quality of existence, constituting personal intention, that is, I do or I intend, for the, you know, substituting that for the I think, in quotes, of idealism, the it is of realism, the I perceive of phenomenology, and the I am of existentialism. Even the I that does or intends, however, is seen to transcend the traditional egocentric predicament by being viewed as constituted at an ontological and not merely a scientific level by the relationships between persons, by the implicit reading of you and I within the explicit I, not self, but person, intentional, acting, and reflective of its interpersonal nature, stands as the key contextual referent and personal, the relationship to the other as end rather than as means, as the fundamental criterion for integrity. Scientific research and theory construction are then subordinated to the claim of the personal, justifiable not in and of themselves, but only in terms of contextual motives that would seek through them the conditions necessary to expand the dimension of the personal. This is due to the fact that such scientific activity represents a temporary withdrawal from the personal relationship back to the egocentric stance that would see the effort as but a means to the resolution of the scientist's cognitive problem. When the research of theoretical activity focuses upon human behavior, the intentional acting character of persons, together with the mutual treatment of the other as end that signifies the personal, must be sacrificed in some measure in exchange for the power of a grammar that would perceive man as determinate object and treat him as means. Approximation to such reflective objectification is unavoidable, even in everyday informal experience. It is, however, always to be judged in terms of the intentional context that surrounds it. Where McMurray tends to fail is in his inability to suggest, beyond the usual bow in the direction of technosocial application, the various ways in which the behavioral sciences, once a contextual frame is acknowledged, may be peculiarly suited to the guaranteeing an extension of the personal. It is just such a calling for sociology that will be explored in the final pages before us. Dialogical possibilities. There will be those who have read this volume with hope and expectation that they have stumbled across another club with which to beat once again what they feel to be the pretentiousness of sociology's claims as a science. But if they do, they will be taken in by altogether private vendetta. For the full import of what has been said here lays the foundation for what may appear to be an outrageously extravagant appraisal of the contribution a science of society may be expected to make to buttressing and extending those humane images that represent our inheritance from the city-states of Greece to the tribes of Israel. Though it has been my intention to draw a harsh caricature of a sociology that would seek its center of reference within itself, the value-free claim, the discipline's informal lifestyle, never succumbing to its own propaganda, has played and will continue to play a remarkably liberating and responsible role in the drama of human existence. All the pieces of the puzzle lie before us and need now but to be fit together. Those that have been missing have been recovered. First, the realization that the scientific rhetoric that distinguishes sociology demands a context. And second, the appropriation of the personal, or some metaphorically equivalent paradigm, as the context for sociology. An epistemology that would reduce social experience to simply a network of determinate objects is transformed, thereby, into man's most reliable instrument for extending meaningful responsibility and substantive freedom, the extension of responsibility. The larger intellectual world, pressed to the wall during the first half of the present century by the formal assumptions and claims of the scientific community, turned to the sanctuary provided by the intrasubjective and countered with the inverse blinders of existence. For here at least, the personal might remain inviolate. Unfortunately, in this process, existential man had to renounce all claim to social responsibility, because any extension from the experience of the immediately intra-subjective demands the reintroduction of order, and the latter, if it were to approach reliably, remained the province of a rejected science. Indeed, to turn for one's compass to existence exclusively could prove at least as tragic as the opposite recourse, the reification of the intersubjective assumptions of science, as may be illustrated by the early Heidegger's dramatic plea to the German people to follow their Führer, on the one hand, and the later Marx's identification with the materialism of science, on the other. It was the dilemma Sartre sought to bridge philosophically in his Critique de la raison dialectique. The larger culture of which we are a part has traditionally assigned the cultivation of responsibility to the family, the church, and the school. The means assumed to be particularly appropriate to this its extension have been exhortation and the cultivation of the discipline. Serious consideration at the adult level is reserved for the discipline of ethics, an exercise that appears too often satisfied with the verbal manipulation of a variety of contending frames of reference, examined in terms of their logical integrity by the philosopher and in terms of their consistency vis-a-vis given traditional doctrines by the theologian. Social ethics has of recent decades begun to be distinguished from its parent as an effort to apply such norms, the roots of which lay historically in face-to-face personal encounter, to situations that reflect the more secondary, indirect interaction that typifies contemporary complex societies. But even in the latter case, the accent has been upon the application of normatively given standards upon descriptively given situations. The contribution of the specialist is seen to lie in linking the two logically and or theologically, not in extending responsibility per se. The latter task is left by and large to exhortation, example, and differential acculturation. It is into this breach that sociologists and their colleagues in neighboring social sciences have marched. Once again, we must acknowledge a fundamental debt to Max Weber, for it was he who insisted that the ultimate aim of the sciences of social man was the enhancement of one's sense of responsibility. The term itself, the Latin re and spondere, to promise, reflects the notion of accountability, answerable for one's conduct. Thus, when one extends the domain of man's accountability, he enlarges his responsibility. And this is exactly what the epistemology of sociology as a social science is uniquely equipped to do. Notice the phrase uniquely equipped. It is not used for affect value. I intend to suggest quite baldly that no other human endeavor, preaching, example, the formal or informal study of ethics, may claim such an advantage. A child is not held responsible either in law or more informally for much of its behavior because it does not realize the potential impact of its acts. Even an adult may be held irresponsible under law if it can be determined that he was at the time incapable of comprehending the potential results of his behavior. If, in other words, he is unable to predict the response that his action will elicit, he is irresponsible. Yet it is precisely this gap that a social science is armed to narrow. Its logic enables it, when applied with a trained intelligence, imagination, and patience, to extract the recurrent from the maze that is social experience and project it into the future, thus informing us of the consequences of the alternative steps that lie immediately before us. By constructing a network of order over time, we are provided with a map by which we may move with foreknowledge into the future and therefore be held, in fact, answerable for the impact of our conduct. Granted that direct existential awareness may assure us of the ineradicable nature of choices per se, still, we are provided by it with no grounding in the social world that we share with others and are sustained only by myth and metaphor in our search for reliability. Exhortation serves merely to focus our attention, the reiteration of habit, but to add to the burden of our compulsiveness. The sciences, by their intersubjective restraint, guarantee a measure of social reliability otherwise unavailable to us. And sociology, concerned as it is with the common denominators of social action in any and every substantively differentiated sphere, would thrust its torch into every niche and cranny of our social world judging nothing to be too petty or commonplace for its attention, and thus extending the domain of the responsible far beyond the boundaries traditionally marked out by ethicists. It demonstrates, thus, a universality of concern seldom shown even by our avowedly universalistic religious tradition. Such universality of concern shades over into the compassion of which Peter Berger has spoken, and on toward the humility that Merton documented in his early study of Calvinist roots of 17th century science. For the cognitive conditions for such qualities are laid down when one uncovers the determinate dimension in any human action. It undergirds as well the substantive realization so central to the sociological stance that man is not man except in community, that he cannot simply choose in the privacy of his existential selfhood the path that will guarantee social maturity and ethical sensitivity, but that he is largely dependent upon responsible interaction with others for his integrity. Sociology can, in a very real sense, then, claim a prime position within the role that a mature Heidegger would grant science as a whole, that of the shepherd of being, as he says. The Weberian case is, then, a sturdy one. If one would accept the definition of responsible behavior offered, a situation in which the actor is aware of the approximate impact his action will have on others, then sociology, concerned as it is with features that underlie all forms of social interaction, would appear to prove the paradigmatic mode for the most reliable extension of responsibility in the human social sphere. Though taken in and of itself, it may project an image of man that would deny the traditional notion of responsibility altogether. Its actual result, when viewed within a larger social context in which choice has a measure of substantive reality, is to enlarge the domain of man's accountability. Rather than settling for the modest claim that sociology enables the trained professional to discover more efficient means-ends linkages, as valid an assertion as that is, we may begin to see it for what in fact it is, a tool much more powerful than logical or theological analyses traditional to the discipline of ethics and or the powers of exhortation, imitation, and habit to expand the range of man's responsibility. There is indeed no other medium but the traditional recourse to revelation by which responsibility may be, or has been, reliably extended. Whenever and wherever such advances have taken place, they must have occurred in a fashion which, although pragmatic and unself-conscious, was immediately analogous to the logic that we have come over the last few generations to systematize as social science. And if one would take our reading of that logic with full seriousness, the gap between it and what theology would identify as revelation may already have largely disappeared. There are, however, two marked boundaries that must encompass and condition what has been claimed. The first is simply this: a shepherd, in quotes, must have, indeed typically has, an aim that may not be in the ultimate interest of the flock. Machiavelli, authentically heralded today as the first self-conscious social scientist of the modern period, could serve a just prince or an evil prince with equal effectiveness. To enlarge the realm of responsible action says nothing whatsoever of its qualitative content. One may enhance the impersonal in as telling a manner as the personal, the manipulation of others for the satiation of one's own needs as adequately as for the fulfillment of the other's own aims. In either case, one is, quote, responsible. The choice cannot be dictated by a logic rooted in the intersubjective, for the latter, as we saw in chapters 9 and 10, provides no fundamental point of departure, but merely a network of predictive relationships. The choice, then, must be made in dialogue with the intra-subjective, for it is there that the texture of experience registers its deepest impact. It is there, as the philosophers and theologians of existence have served to remind the present generation, that issues of being and non-being, the grounding of good and the grounding of evil, of alienation and authenticity, are to be confronted. and only if one perceives at that level that it is the integrity of the person that must serve as social compass, will we be in a position to avoid the egocentric predicament that is the product of intentional or unintentional reification of the presumptions of science. Once again, we find that the scientific frame is not merely alternative, but nested as well. It resides, whether it would or not, in a larger world of experiences that includes the intra-subjective. The nurturing of freedom. The second boundary is established by the paradoxical nature of social science, which we pointed out in Chapter 8 and mentioned in our discussion of the dialectical paradigm. The paradox lies in the startling fact that the actual procedures necessarily and in principle adhering to social research are shot through with an implicit commitment towards change. Unavoidable in the application of the control necessary to approximate the experimental paradigm that governs verification, confronted in the interaction that is observation, magnified through the acts of communication that define science as a plural enterprise, it is seen most dramatically in the impact that the very perception of order within social experience has upon the future behavior of those who share the perception. We discovered that the inverse of Merton's self-fulfilling prophecy syndrome, suicidal or self-denying prophecy, must be extended to cover in some measure over the short or long run all social research. That in the very process of precipitating and comprehending recurrent patterns of social behavior, we were introducing factors that would act in principle to deny their full validity when projected into the future. We were therefore forced to conclude that all social research was in some measure action research, that by the very fact that the sociologist himself was part of the interactive circle of action he sought to predict, social laws are not that cannot be stable over the long run. Only by projecting an imaginary social universe in which there were no history and no social scientists, indeed no laymen who could come informally and pragmatically to comparable perceptions, might sociology continue in its secure assumptions that there are indeed fundamental social, quote, laws to be deciphered and proclaimed valid at least until man's biological structure has itself taken new form. And not only are we unable to provide adequately for such feedback through experience with it over time, but the very paradox itself is not amenable to statement as law, for in either case, such provision or such a law would be subject to the very same erosion. And again, in principle, Merton's hesitancy to advocate, for the present generation at least, any aim beyond the derivation of theories of the middle range may well have resulted in part from his sensitivity to the prophetic nature of social prediction. Certainly, the advice would seem to have been in the right direction, but even this admonition will have to be reinterpreted or rephrased to add a temporal dimension to its concern for the level of generalization, if it is to provide fruitful guidance to the novitiate. The stance taken by Merton's younger associate in the sociology of science, Bernard Barber, would appear preferable. Barber recommends that largely because of the paradox under discussion, we limit ourselves to continual short-range prediction. It is an immediately analogous transcendence of the given structures of everyday reality that informs the comic motif that dominates the invitation to sociology that Peter Berger would set before us. The tragic destiny of 1984 is not at all suitable in its light. Rather, it is the clown-like figure of man caught up in the compulsive routines of a drama he assumes has been authored by nature or by God that occupies center stage. The tragic mode must give way to the comic because of the image projected by an Adam who is congenitively indisposed to acknowledge to himself that it was in fact he who allotted the roles and wrote the script, and second, because sociology has the capacity to reveal the human comedy in its full dimensions. But most important, although the vision is precarious, through it Adam may be freed, at least momentarily, to reconstruct the order of his existence in terms of a more authentic script. It is no accident that humor is man's most potent weapon for self-disclosure, nor that he stands alone among the animals in possessing it. For it is intimately tied to his unique capacity to create his own culture, together with his ineradicable temptation to deny his responsibility at one moment and his freedom to create anew at the next. The general character of the liberating process of which Berger speaks is not, of course, a fundamentally new insight, only its specific application to the breaking of the bonds of fictitiousness that appear all to the functional in the social sphere is new. Furthermore, dialectical philosophy and theology have long linked freedom with the perception of order. What is unique in the present formulation is that it moves beyond the level of mere assertion and or faith to the description in empirically relevant terms of the epistemological basis for the claim. Through the sociologist's capacity to grasp the fact that social research actually stands within the dialectic that is social interaction, he stands in an enviable position to spell out the substantively verifiable manner in which the very perception of order will contribute to freeing one from compulsive repetition. And, as in the case of responsibility, there is every reason to assert that his calling, because of its patient dedication to the harsh master that is empirical fact, holds a key far more reliable and sustaining than the traditional recourse to sheer rhetoric and admonition to guarantee the extension and preservation of man's liberating and creative faculty. But, once again, the limits of a logic rooted in the intersubjective alone must be drawn, for liberation, as well as responsibility, is a two-sided sword. One may turn one's freedom from the shackles of the past towards aggrandizement as readily as to compassion. One may free oneself from restraint all the better to restrain. One may destroy the security that others find in an ordered past to feed one's own private security, shatter a functional relationship at large to nourish one at home. One may be freed to achieve community or to accomplish mastery. The final grounds for choice, as we have seen earlier, although informed by the empirical, lie rooted in the intra-subjective. Only if we assume that the presumptive framework to which sociology as a science makes claim is contained within a larger dialogue that includes the existential, and is drawn by the latter towards a fundamental respect for personal integrity, may the freedom we enhance be distinguished from nihilism, or through the conscious or unconscious reification of but the assumptions that grant sociology its power, lead us to transform man into mere object. One may be tempted to characterize the overall posture now before us as a simple extension of a term that is traditional to the vocabulary of philosophy and that we have made considerable use of to this point, that is, the adjective dialectical. There is no doubt that it does indeed apply to the manner in which sociology contributes interactively to the substantive extension of both man's responsibility and his freedom. It is not, however, equally appropriate for designating the larger stance for at least two reasons. The first, of lesser importance, is the fear that it would serve too handily the inclinations of those who are tempered to substitute categorization and conceptual stereotyping for the exercise of reason and the effort to comprehend. The message is not Hegelian, consciously or otherwise. Experience is the residual epistemological category, not idea. It is equally apparent that it is not an extrapolation of Marx, early or late. It should be taken, not in a private shorthand, but for what it is, the product of a wide range of intellectual influences and sympathies. The second, and by far more important, is the fact that dialectical has traditionally been used to characterize the nature of a single logic, to be distinguished thereby from other singular logics, such as the Aristotelian. A crucial characteristic of the present formulation, on the other hand, is that it seeks to engage two quite distinct epistemologies within the framework of dialogue. Sociology does not thereby abandon the logic traditional to natural science for one appropriate to history. It does not seek to replace Aristotle with Hegel, Mill with Mills, Parsons with Sartre. Existential sensitivity is no substitute for empirical verifiability, or vice versa. What it says is that the two predispositions, the one suitable to the concern for reliability evidenced by natural science, and the other appropriate to the risk demanded by a sensitivity to the ground that is personal existence, must inform each other if either is to bear the fruit, any fruit, for man. Indeed, it says more than that. It declares that they do. That social man unavoidably orients himself in terms of two levels of experience, the intersubjective and the intrasubjective, the public and the private, the empirical and the existential, and that to continue to ignore that fact, as the subcultures grouped around either pole have been tempted to do, reflects in cognitive form but the egocentric predicament that has been the mark of man's creature-likeness, individual and corporate. It is for these reasons, then, that I would choose the term dialogical to characterize the epistemological situation in which we find ourselves. It does not reflect a metaphysical or ontological dualism of any sort. Experience, its grounding referent, is one. It is modern world's vocabulary and grammar, and the structures that frame socialization in her separate intellectual subcultures that have created that dualism. There is no doubt that the two polar rhetorics in fact shade into one another, and indeed have only gradually come to be differentiated from one another in recent centuries. When and if they will regain unity, they once claimed is for the future to reveal, the present generation may hope at most to begin to rebuild lines of communication. The sociologist, with ears professionally sensitized to evidence of dialogue and its absence, is in a privileged position to amplify both the subliminal evidence for and the conscious disclaimer of such interaction, to assist in revealing the fact that even epistemology, as currently structured, must be viewed as an essentially social enterprise. But in the process, we will be forced to reconstruct his own image of the calling of sociology. We come finally to the last section of this book, Sociologist, Witness to Dialogue. Thomas Kuhn, whose The Structure of Scientific Revolutions served as port of embarkation for the voyage we have taken through this turbulent seas of sociology, has much to offer those who would aspire to chart the shoals and hidden reefs that comprise a sociology of sociology. An awareness that a science must, as it moves towards maturity, coalesce about a single substantive paradigm is balanced by the discovery that the ordering of empirical phenomena within a given field takes place within the bounds of accepted gestalt only until the amplitude it has afforded man's predictive understanding has heightened the community's awareness of anomaly as well. For when the latter has persisted in the developmental history of a natural science, it has ultimately led, after a period of trial, epistemological soul-searching, and conflict, to the revolutionary rejection of the former paradigm and the crowning of the new, it is a tale not simply of steady progress made as one level of order is precipitated upon the sediment of previous experience of order, but one in which the period of sustained development alternates with very real and very harsh competition for paradigmatic supremacy. The rewards that the stencil offers a sociology of sociology were revealed in the first portion of this volume. We found that sociology did tend to move out of an eclectic adolescence toward coalescence about an orthodoxy spelled out in terms of system and the derivative notion of function. That the late 50s and early 60s found the field wrestling with the issue of fundamental social change a stubborn anomaly when addressed by a conceptual model which saw instability its final point of reference. and that the 60s brought with them a major movement, particularly among younger sociologists, towards replacing system with conflict in the position of prime paradigmatic honor. At the edge of battle stood a small band of mediators pre-offering a dialectical flag as a means to an honorable peace without victory or defeat. To take the latter group seriously, however, would be to reject Kuhn's central thesis and the epistemological assumptions which it drew its strength from. Revolutions, by definition, imply the overthrow of the orthodox and the acquisition of supreme power by the victorious combatant, while the revolutionary model itself was projected as infinitely repetitive. Kuhn's error lies precisely where one might expect it to lie, with the fact that, trained in the physical sciences, he brought to his task the assumption of recurrence native to that province. But his exercise was in neither the history nor the philosophy of science, it was rather in sociology, the sociology of science. And in this, its pursuit, as with the great majority of trained sociologists, it was simply unaware of the fundamental paradox that differentiates the logic of the social sciences from that of the physical and the biological. For in an exercise such as his own, the very knowledge we gain in the periodic cresting of paradigmatic revolutions in the past may be fed back as a new and unique factor in science's communal life, enabling the latter to break with the compulsive routines that would lead once again to monopolization of orthodoxy by a single paradigm. As a result, revolution, in quotes, may after a time no longer be the appropriate image. With the growing realization that all specific conceptual and empirical activity within a science is dependent ultimately on a larger given gestalt, scientific communities may themselves come to accept a fundamental pluralism as an appropriate style for the life of scientific mind, just as much of the latter populace of the West has come to accept pluralism in civic and religious life as an appropriate response to an awareness of the repetitive nature of revolutions in the history of the civic sphere. There is indeed some slim evidence already available that this has in fact already begun to occur within the natural sciences themselves. It is with the social sciences, however, that one should expect the pluralistic motif to come to the fore initially. Hard evidence in support of one paradigm to the exclusion of another is too difficult to come by to dull the social scientists' appreciation of the long-range value of peaceful paradigmatic coexistence. This need not mean any slackening of competition. Indeed, competition can only be guaranteed when it is encompassed by an allegiance to a larger loyalty. But it does mean for sociology that the candidacy of the, quote, dialectic would be immeasurably strengthened, for it, like the paradigm of democracy, in the truly pluralistic sense, grants a place to competing paradigms, if but a secondary place. Loyalties to competing paradigms within either the dialectical or democratic frames play active and fruitful roles. Kuhn's analysis, then, is epistemologically short-sighted, a visual handicap which, although inherited from his epistemological lineage and not to be blamed on Kuhn himself, is nonetheless real. The dialectical paradigm may be expected to gain ground in the decade of the 70s at the expense of both the system and conflict motifs. There is little likelihood, however, that it will be reported or perhaps even seen as dominating the sociological scene for one very self-evident reason, and that is, of course, because its public image has been so terribly bruised by its association with the term materialism. The professionally knowledgeable will strike it from their applications for public funds, while editors will cast it from the manuscripts for elementary texts. Sociology, having just won the battle to distinguish itself from socialism, will be archly conscious of any future semantic booby trap. Yet a paradigm need not be consciously voiced to play a part. A growing accommodation and mutual appreciation among those publicly espoused to system and those wed to conflict may come to be its only badge. In the longer run, however, the association with the Marxist heritage may act, in fact, to strengthen the dialectic's claim. With the recognition that the phrase dialectical materialism is a little likely to be abandoned in Eastern Europe as God will in fact die in the vocabulary of the West, together with the conscious effort of both camps to build conceptual bridges and the specific steps taken in the 60s to transform national sociologies into a truly international discipline, there will be much sustained effort to reframe the dialectical in terms that transcend ideological frontiers. Although most of that effort may be expected to come from the conceptually more flexible West, the author himself was witness to the suggestion by a prominent Soviet colleague in the context of an informal discussion that system theory might well be appropriate for the analysis of social structure, while dialectical theory was reserved for the analysis of social dynamics. We pointed out at the end of Chapter 2 a major addendum that we would have to make to Kuhn's thesis. In extrapolating his model to the social sciences, we discovered that it was necessary to introduce an additional paradigmatic level, one that would focus upon the sociologist's self-image. This was due again to the fact that the socially relevant activity of the social scientist, including therefore the image that guided his research role, was itself a prime candidate for inclusion within the sociologist's range of concern, particularly when the specific area under consideration was the sociology of science. Thus, the contrasting images of the sociologist as prophet and as priest were introduced, and it was noted that the typically implicit choice for emphasis between them appeared to govern one's choice between such substantive paradigms as conflict and system. The paradigm addressed to the sociologist's self-image was deemed primary. That designated the substantive nature of sociology's subject matter secondary, for a prophetic posture appeared to beget that conflict model and a priestly stance, system. Earlier in the present chapter, however, we suggested that as the fundamentally dialectical nature of social research became more apparent, the former linkages would be apt to part. That the recent return to prophecy within the discipline might well avail itself to the tool of system analysis, while the conflict paradigm could in fact mask a dedication to some more fundamental posture, which, if it were to be revealed, would represent the sociologist in priestly terms, strikingly akin to those projected by Comte's positivist society of the future. Although I have both revealed and admitted my support for the current reclamation of the prophetic mode, it does not mean that I would at the same time deny the priestly. Rather, informed by the dialogical nature of the relationship between intra- and intersubjective experience, I would both expect and encourage a pluralism at the level of self-image, just as I would expect and encourage it at the level of substantive paradigm. Although the prophetic and the priestly modes enlighten one's image of the fundamental nature of sociology's subject matter, the former is rooted in a sensitivity to the intrasubjective, the latter in a preferential response to the intersubjective. Although sociology as a science lays peculiar claim to the latter, we have discovered that it is impossible, not just inappropriate, but impossible to resolve the value-laden choices forced upon one in social research without recourse to the existential level of awareness. Not even when the sociologist turns implicitly or explicitly to a reification of the epistemology or an extrapolation of the norms of science itself does he avoid such dialogue. For the choice cannot be dictated by the intersubjective alone. It not only provides no point of reference, but would deny the reality of the choice itself. Thus it is that although the one will appear dominant at one moment in sociology's history, and the second at another, the prophetic and the priestly modes will continue in dialogue, as they do in the larger religious philosophical life of our kind. If one would seek a term that would envelop both the active and the passive, the liberating and the ordering, nature of our calling as sociologists, perhaps witness may do, the sociologist could be witness to the profoundly social dialogue that is man. The end.